Yes, now the floor is yours. Who wants to be the first one to raise a question to one of the panel members or to speak out without wanting to have an answer, just to clear his mind? Not everybody at the same time. Yeah, okay, yeah, please. Eric, there's a mic coming to you.
I belong to the child protection sector in India, the sector which is very grossly underrepresented in this book. And
could you also give your name, please?
I'm Pallavi. I'm a student of Institute of Social Studies in The Hague, and I study development studies. But I also have some experience in the child protection sector in India, work with the street children and children under various designations and labeled as children who are affected by HIV AIDS and refugee children. But in your book, I was leafing through it and I was wondering why there is no mention of child protection as a sector, especially when you talk about urbanization, you should take a look at street children and their problems. When you talk about border issues, you should take a look at children who are of refugees who have no status on paper. When you talk about war, then you should take a look at children in armed conflicts. And somewhere, I mean, when this goes missing, I mean, it's just a target, just like women. I mean, you're just doing lip service. And you're towing the traditional line of giving children voices and giving children education to make them more empowered. But child protection is synonymous with security. And global security really has to take a look at it. And I was wondering why the exclusion.
Thank you very much. I propose that we collect a few questions or comments before we give the panel the chance to react. Who else? Yeah, Georg.
Hey, Georg Werks. I'm professor of conflict studies at Utrecht University and disaster studies at Wageningen University. I have basically two remarks. I didn't have the advantage of reading the book because I just bought it. So perhaps it's my ignorance. First of all, what I found remarkable, in a way, the presentations of Professor Voorhoeven and Professor Rabbinger, and also what the Secretary of State said, is that there are many ways in which we can improve our performance. In agriculture, it seems that a lot of benefits and improvements can be reached, and apparently we know that. Eco-efficiency, agro-efficiency, and also humanitarian efficiency, in a way, if you would calculate your measures in the correct manner. I have a more general question on that. What are the impediments? Is it the knowledge? Is it the fact that we don't know how to apply the knowledge? Is it policies? Is it a market which is not interested? Where do we have the bottlenecks? And it seems to me that also a political or institutional analysis would be of the essence in discussing this type of implementation problems, if you want to call them like that. I was also intrigued by the remark and by the observations on what is happening in China at the moment and your plea and to a certain degree the confidence that if something is applicable and seems to work, that the market will pick it up and that it will be applied. I'm not so sure about that, whether all the security problems which we may have in the world, and child protection I think was one of them, but I could think of many more in parts of the world where there is no purchasing power, where people are deprived and disprivileged. So is there not the risk, I'm not saying you argue for this as a general strategy, but if we have too much confidence in the market, that large sections of underprivileged people will be left out. And I think it is with globalization, you can call it a force for inclusion, but you can also call it a force for exclusion. And I think we have to take perhaps that double perspective, and I would like to invite your comments on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Hura. Maybe one other question. I see Dane Ratliff, the Permanent Court of Arbitration.
Thank you very much. Just based on the comment that Mr. Flavin made regarding the International Criminal Court and the lack of overall attention it seems that the report has given to it, it seems you're pessimistic about the role that international environmental law can play in bolstering environmental security. I should mention my name is Dane Ratliff. I work for the Permanent Court of Arbitration in this building. And here at the seat of the PCA, numerous disputes involving environment and natural resources have been resolved, from those involving the legality of transport of nuclear fuels to those that involve river pollution or fisheries disputes. It's true that good global governance will ensure good faith implementation of environmental obligations that have been undertaken in environmental agreements, but I equally think that access to justice is an important part in ensuring the implementation of environmental good governance. And on the point of eco-efficiency, for Mr. Van Hoogstraten, I would invite him to replace the light bulbs in the Peace Palace with low wattage, high luminosity equivalent bulbs. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Dane. Maybe this is a good moment to ask the panel whether they would react. I think everybody who wants to react, you know, will have a chance to do so. You have the child protection. Why is it not in the report? That is not explicitly addressed. What are the bottlenecks to eco-efficiency, et cetera, agro-efficiency markets, exclusion of people, you know, inclusion of people, access to justice, and changing light bulbs here. Panel, that's, who wants to react? Michael.
Yeah, maybe just real quick on the first issue, the child protection. I think your point is very well taken, and thank you very much for raising it. I guess I would slightly disagree. It's not an issue that I think we excluded, certainly not consciously, but I think you could probably rightly accuse us of not making it as visible as maybe it ought to be. It is something that is addressed in a variety of ways in the second chapter on population. Again, indirectly on the HIV issue in the health chapter, and also in the chapter on the small arms proliferation issues. But I think it's something that maybe we should really keep in mind for next editions of the book. And because I think you could always argue that any number of issues, you can sort of slice them in different ways. And depending on how you do that, certain issues will become more prominent and others will seem to be left out. Whether that's intentional or not, I guess is a somewhat different issue. But I want to thank you very much for raising that. That's a well taken point.
Thank you. Chris?
Let me respond to a couple of points. First, on the International Criminal Court, if you heard me to say something against the court or its importance, I was miscommunicating because that's certainly not my view or the view of the Institute. You know, we think that this kind of international judicial process is extremely important and, in fact, should be more broadly utilized for more issues. And I was interesting to hear that environmental issues are in principle now being brought towards the court, but that there have not been any specific cases yet. We think that moving more in that direction is something that makes an awful lot of sense. I guess the only point of context that I would reinforce is that, you know, we can't assume that we can just take everything to the crisis of an actual legal confrontation. I mean, there have to be efforts, but I think everyone recognizes that an international legal response is only a small part of a broader set of actions that we need to take to address these problems. Let me respond also to the this question of the role of markets. And again, I was certainly not meaning to say either in the energy sector, but certainly not for the issues more broadly, that the market by itself is going to solve all problems. That certainly is not something that I think is supported by the evidence, and I don't think it's something that we've been arguing either here today or in the pages of the book. And there are many social issues in particular, as well as particular environmental issues, that are only going to be addressed if you have governmental intervention. And in all of the sort of euphoria over globalization, I think, unfortunately, many in the private sector are forgetting, or at least for a time have forgotten, the fact that a strong, robust public sector is essential, working together with the private sector and markets in solving problems. And in fact, the specific point I was making on renewable energy, where I was pointing out that there are basically four or five countries that have really created an incipient global revolution in renewable energy. Now, what do those five or so countries have in common? They're certainly not the countries with the best renewable resources. They're certainly not the only countries that have strong private sectors and the capability to innovate. What they have in common is a strong government policy. Governments got in and changed the regulation. The regulations, which basically have protected monopolies that have liked to build large nuclear and coal plants, and opened that up to small entrepreneurs that wanted to build renewable energy. So the government intervention came first, and the private sector investment came second. And the key message that I think is important to convey is that this would not have happened with either one of those alone. If you had asked government themselves to do this, you would have probably had, you know, a lot of costly gold-plated projects that wouldn't have worked, because we saw that tried by many governments, including my own, in the 1970s. But the private sector could not have begun to be engaged if you didn't have the change in governmental laws. And so that's what we really need, is a strong partnership between the public and private sectors.
Thank you. Second round for the room, please. Yeah, Gottfried Lebrandt.
Let me first of all say how refreshing I find this panel this afternoon. So many new ideas and challenging ideas have put forward. That is just a pleasure to be here. It's maybe because of my background, which is education, I missed a bit the emphasis on the role of education and research. Although, of course, many remarks presupposes developments in research, because all what you have been saying is that innovation is what we need to face the coming problems. And for this innovation, I think research is very, very important, and it has to be more or less sometimes a bit guided, I guess, or stimulated. And the same goes, of course, for education. I'm thinking about policymakers who has to be educated better to cope with these problems, but I also think about people in industry and what have you. Thank you.
Thank you, Gottfried. Somebody else, or we had a tough afternoon. And I see two. Yeah, Annemarie Goedmakers.
Thank you. My name is Piet Witt.
I first recognized Annemarie. You know her?
You give her first.
Piet.
Okay, we'll fight afterwards.
Yeah. Okay, introduce yourself, Annemarie, please.
My name is Annemarie Goodmakers, and I'm the president of the Foundation of Rural Energy Services. I think the issue that was raised about R&D in the energy sector is very, very important. The fact that in this issue where we have so many problems, the amount of money spent on R&D is decreasing. It's a fact that I think is only known in certain areas, but we should bring it more to the public, and we should stress it that the amount should be increased. Industries should be pushed or tempted to increase their amounts on it, and it should be spent on the right issues. I remember during my time in the European Parliament that we adopted an amendment to the budget that 50% that the energy R&D should be spent 50% on nuclear and other sources. It was a slight attempt to reshift focus, but I think since then there hasn't been much attention for it. So if this could be picked up by all the people here and put forward as an idea to put politicians on the right track, I think that would be a welcome issue.
Thank you, Annemarie. Very clear plea for better R&D. Piet Witt. and you are the last from the floor.
Thank you, Piet Wit. I'm mentioned here as director of Syzygy, which is a very small firm dealing with ecology and development. But I'm also a member of CIMIC, which stands for Civil Military Cooperation. There's a unit within the Dutch Army that is dealing with rebuilding the civil society as early as possible during the conflict. And I think that it is important, especially when you talk about environmental issues, you address these issues as early as possible during that conflict. I always say a bridge you can rebuild, even after 10 years, but if you have destroyed an ecosystem on which people depend and nature depend, then it is, in human lifetime, virtually impossible to re-establish that. So you have to be there as early as possible, and that's one of the reasons why I joined this unit. I would like to have ideas from the panel, how they would see the role of the military during conflict in terms of environmental security. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, that concludes the round from the floor. We have a plea for more R&D in the field of energy. I think Wim would like to respond to that, maybe others as well. Also about efficiency, maybe in the agrosphere. Maybe Rudy, you can give a last comment on that. The role of education, extremely important, and the role of the military to either prevent environmental damage or to help restore it after the fact. I should say that Pete is also his captain.